Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the new shadow, Amicus Veritas. Today, we're going to deal with the gullibility of the media, and of course, it's kind of interesting. It's interesting that P.T. Barnum was born on this day, and let's see, I think it was 18th. Let me get it right here. P.T. Barnum, 1873. And he started that circus in New York called The Greatest Show on Earth. Later became a movie. But there's some dispute that he made this statement, but it's generally attributed to him. A sucker is born every minute. And that could be applied to the people, a lot of people in the media, whether it's corporate, alternative, or political media, that... I was watching, and the world was watching, the whole world was watching, I guess we could say, that little escapade of the hot air balloon and the hot air episode of the kid that was supposed to be in it. I looked at the balloon, I thought, well, where the heck could this kid, how could he get in this balloon? And also with the helicopter and the aircraft that was following it, would they not have seen something, a human or whatever, in that balloon? And also, what about radar? We can use our satellite equipment way up there in the ionosphere and beyond to pinpoint a license plate down here on Earth, many thousands of miles away. So the technology is there. I don't know if they had it available in Colorado, but there's been a lot of scandals coming out of Colorado lately. The Matthew Shepard scandal, which is the media has fallen for, the innocence of this young man, which was a drug deal gone down bad. The two kids, two youths that two other guys had killed him. Yes, it was very brutal, and they needed to be tried, punished, and they were convicted. However, the murder wasn't the way that the homosexual propagandists would have foisted on what has been a gullible media. It was a drug deal, and it's documented in What's the Matter with California, related by Jack Cashel, Bill Brumbaugh, famous newscaster, broadcaster. He's off the air right now. He's been very ill. And other people have exposed this fraud, and the gullible media has eaten it up or swallowed it whole, and it's sticking in their craw. And that's not the only one. The 69 Stonewall Tavern dispute in New York City, Greenwich Village, was not about homosexuals. It was about a mafia-controlled bar involved in prostitution and also serving liquor to underage kids. The guy who started it later became a transsexual, and then he died of AIDS recently. But before he died, he confessed that he started it. I think the kid's name was Garcia, if I'm not mistaken. And he was 17 years old. And as those of you who live in New York and Quebec and other states know, in Wisconsin, that 18 is the lowest, that was the lowest drinking age in North America. I don't know about Mexico, but that's one of the big frauds. And then the Harvey Milk, he was not the first gay public official elected. There was somebody in another part of the country back, I think in the early 70s, and also in San Francisco, late 50s, early 60s, was a guy named Christensen. Mayor George Christopher knew him, and he was on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. He was gay. He later disappeared and ended up in Arizona, and he died a couple years ago. but Harvey Milk was just a hustler from New York. He did serve in the U.S. Navy. He claimed he was gay when he was 17, and this is another controversy about homosexuals not being able to serve in the service either. They have served, and they behaved themselves and kept their mouth shut, their sleeves down, and their zippers up, or they got a pass from some officer or whatever. But, you know, this is another one of the propaganda from the homosexual political and media machine that gullible people are swallowing up. But this doesn't stop there. One of the most, one of the earliest in this century media frauds was the Piltown Man. That was a supposed archaeological find about 1912 in the village Piltown in England. It's a rural village. And they were trying to pass this off. A guy named Charles Dawson, I think, was trying to pass this off as an archaeological find of the earliest known man. Well, what it turned out, in 1953, the fraud was exposed. It took that long. It turned out to be the lower jaw of an argantuan and a human skull. But, you know, this is an example of gullible people swallowing these frauds, these media frauds, hook, line, and sinker. Another media fraud is that of Al Capone and Elliot Ness. And now, there was this infamous, or it depends how you look at it, series on TV called The Untouchables, which was in the 50s. I remember as a kid in school, we watched it on the dorm TV and in high school went into the 60s. And it was promoted by Walter Winchell, a very controversial, racist, hack columnist for the Hearst newspaper chain. His parents were Russian Jewish immigrants. I don't think he practiced, and he was very slimy. But he had this produced this thing, or had a hand in creating Elliot Ness as the guy who brought down Al Capone, and it's a big fat fraud. The guy who brought down Al Capone was a U.S. Treasury accountant named Elmer Irie. Jewish boy, I believe, and he somehow they got Al Capone's books. And as I said, as I tell people, even in Watergate, all the lawyers went to jail, you know, the arrogance of that profession. But the accountant, Maurice Stans, walked. He was acquitted. That's the guy you got to watch, I believe, in my political experience, the accountant, because he knows where the books are and where there's another set and what's in those books. And all these offshore bank accounts. Lawyers think that their bar card, or the arrogant ones think their bar card gives them immunity, and they can bamboozle anybody with the fast talk and this business of authority and omnipotence and knowing everything when they don't. But that's one of the big frauds that big frauds that Walter Winchell pulled off on a gullible press and people, gullible American people, still believe that today. The other thing that he pulled after World War II, the infamous Tokyo Rose, or Rose Diakino, she married a Filipino. She was a Japanese American. I shouldn't use that because I criticize those hyphenated Americans. Her parents were Japanese who immigrated to the United States. She was they were legal. She was born in Los Angeles, and the habit of the what they call the I think the sensei, the first born Japanese children. In those days, was to send them back, if they could afford it, they'd get the money to send them back to Japan to learn the culture and the language. Well, she got stuck over there after Pearl Harbor. She was there, and Pearl Harbor happened, and what Tojo's people and what they call the Kempeitai, which was the Japanese version of the Gestapo or the KGB or the Cheka or NKVD in those days, was a secret police, the terrorist organization of the Japanese Tojo's government. And there were about 20 of these young girls or young ladies, and they were told, they all spoke good English, and they were told, you broadcast or else you go to the concentration camp or you get executed. And here she was, I think she was about 20 years old, and she had no choice. And there was an Australian who also was part of that broadcasting, and I think an American who was captured. But all, we had the situation with the British, a guy named Lord Haha, who willingly collaborated with the Nazis, and he broadcast spurious propaganda over the airwaves of Nazi radio, Goebbels radio. We also had an American woman, her name escapes me, and she ended up in St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. Lord Haha was, when the British won the war, won their part of the war, they captured Lord Haha, and he was tried and executed. And the British are very good and very efficient at doing this. They did this to another guy who supported, an Irishman who supported the Germans in World War One. I forget his name. Good, I must be getting old. But anyway, what happened was everybody, because Walter Winchell and the Hearst papers whipped up this frenzy to get Tokyo Rose, which was just a name given to a group of women. When the Americans landed in Tokyo, the newspaper people and the military were running around trying to locate, quote, Tokyo Rose. Rose Diakino happened to be at the radio station or in the vicinity, and she was fingered as the Tokyo Rose when she was just one of 20 young women. And she did her best to help Americans who were and allies who were prisoners of the Japanese, because the Japanese were very brutal to Allied POWs. And we can get into that in another show, which I'm going to do in November, honoring the military of the nations who have fought in the wars in this century. We have a lot of tapes that we are now dissecting to edit them down so they're broadcast shortness and quality. Anyway, there were Americans who told the MacArthur's people, hey, you know, she was just one of 20, and she really wasn't a traitor. You know, was forced to do this. And, of course, what would you do if you were in a similar situation? That's something people should think about. And the Justice Department at the time, I think it was Attorney General Biddle, and it was Harry Truman's administration, they were not going to prosecute her. But Walter Winchell started this hysteria, and I think it was another so-called journalist or columnist, Westbrook Pegler, who was a racist and anti-Catholic, among other things, whipped up this media frenzy against her. So what the Justice Department decided to prosecute her, but the rule was, the federal rules of procedure was, if an American had committed treason or was accused of committing treason and against the country during wartime or at that time, I think the statute may have changed, they were to be brought to the nearest U.S. district court. In that case, it would have been Honolulu. But the people in the Justice Department who got caught up in this frenzy decided that they couldn't get a jury that would convict her because there were a lot of Asians living in Honolulu, a lot of Japanese, Chinese, Filipinos, Hawaiians. So what did they do? They bring her to San Francisco where there was a lot of hysteria. Still, the evacuation or the forced removal of Japanese by General DeWitt and Governor Earl Warren, who later became Chief Justice of the United States, something he regretted and didn't want to talk about, but he did it. And so they knew they could get a hanging jury here in San Francisco. And I was partially involved in the tail end of that case when President Ford decided to pardon Rose Diakino. Rose had married a Filipino, I think, in Japan, and he was barred from ever entering the United States. She was pregnant, and she suffered a miscarriage at some time during this hysteria. Anyway, Wayne Collins Sr. was the lawyer. The ACLU, when they were good guys, got involved in her case, but she was convicted, and we're going to put this up on the web because that courthouse still stands. There's a lot of infamy connected with the Ninth Federal Circuit. And she was convicted and shipped off to a prison in West Virginia. After she was pardoned in the early part of the Ford administration, she went to Chicago and set up a store called Taguri. And I had met her there when I was back there visiting classmates and all that. And she died recently, and then I think it was one of the cable channels did a biography of her trying to rehabilitate her memory and tell the truth. And, of course, Walter Winchell, you know, got away with this. Like a lot of these media people, like people like Maddow and Oberman, and there are other media slime that, tell these lies, distortions, and omissions. But anyway, that's one example of major media people and columnists pulling these stunts, and they need to be held accountable. But they're, unlike the doctors and even the legal profession, there are rules and committees that are supposed to oversee the behavior, the proper behavior of the people in their profession. But there's nothing for people in the media. So they're like stray dogs that dump on your rose bush and then run away, and you got to clean up their mess. So that, you know, that's how you look at it. Real journalists don't do these things. So that's one of the, you know, media fraud. And then the way, there's another interesting thing, and those of you who pay close attention to what the content and the appearance of the media today, have you noticed all of the lavender and the purple that these people are wearing, whether it's ties, and it's not only Americans, it's not only on PBS, it's not only on the other channels, even Fox News, which surprised me, we see foreign leaders, the Chancellor of Germany, we see Gordon Brown, who's flaked out. I think he's losing it or lost it. And even Sarkozy was wearing a purple tie. So you got to wonder. But also we are now seeing all kinds of black people, black Americans, some of who are very qualified, and you wonder, where have they been? Why are they now servicing? Is it because Obama's in the White House and they're trying to cater to that, or what? But, of course, we got our usual flakes. We got Al Sharpton and Juan Williams, you know, these tired propagandists who push in the same pablum. And, of course, Jesse Jackson's been silent lately. Maybe he's looking for another federal program. I had to look at that, one of his programs many years ago when I was a federal analyst. But anyway, Operation Push, it was called. I called it Operation Puff because all it was in what was a Catholic church in the south side of Chicago, former Catholic church, Corpus Christi, I think. And all it was a food stamp operation and a CD, which was the communications media at the time, CB radio system, which supposedly reported instances of Chicago police brutality on blacks or toward blacks. And it wasn't all the things it was hepped up to be, and so I reported back to my superiors what I had saw and made my report, and I ended it calling it Operation Puff. And Jesse Jackson has never forgiven me. But some other interesting dates here in history. In 1774, the Continental Congress, get this, issued a proclamation discouraging horse racing, gambling, cockfighting, I guess dogfighting would have been included in that because that was done. It was bear baiting. That was also done. And, you know, some of the early anti-animal cruelty laws were propagated in New England. I did an article for the American Kennel Club, I should put it up on the web, on animal law. And I did a project for a judge on legal research on the history of animal law, one of my specialties. And there was, when the Puritans had their churches, they were cheap when it came to heat. And, of course, they had to go to service and I forget, community house, I think that's what they called it. And what they did was to keep warm, they didn't bring in enough fuel to keep the building warm, so they huddled together, and then you hear this term bundling, which has a sexual connotation, but they also brought in their dogs to keep them warm, and the dogs would get rowdy and fight. So they created the role, position of dog whipper to keep the Puritans' dogs under control and from fighting with each other. And, of course, there's a famous song out of Australia called Three Dog Night, and what that means, if you want to keep warm in the outback, you got to sleep with three dogs. And homeless people know that too well, although that's not funny. In 1811, Robert Fulton developed a steamboat called the New Orleans, and that was floating down the Mississippi. And, of course, in 1873, P.T. Barnum was born. We went over him. And one of the real journalists, he had one of the greatest voices I've heard in radio and in TV, Robert Trout. He also served as a correspondent with Walter Cronkite, and he joined CBS in 1932. It's interesting. CBS was started by Walter Paley. He was Russian Jewish background. His name was Pilevsky, actually, and they became Episcopalians when he married a woman. I guess that was her faith. And the money to start the radio station and the radio business came out of the cigar business. Very interesting. And now there's some other interesting history. Edward R. Murrow, who later he was the one who was the broadcaster in the McCarthy Armney hearings, which are still controversial to this day. And there's McCarthy may not have gotten a full due process, let's put it in from the media's point of view, because there's some new things that have come out, including Whittaker Chambers' book on what really happened. But there was a controversy involving a Lieutenant Radulovich, and he was being guilt by association, and Murrow was going to broadcast this, and CBS spiked it. And Roy Cohn was McCarthy's lawyer, and a lot of people don't know this, but Roy Cohn liked young boys, and he was paying $100 a pop, and he died of AIDS. He was very brilliant. This is something that's not known about Cohn. He finished law school, I think, when he was 20. He got through in 2 years. His father, I think, was a judge or well off. And during the Rosenberg trials, those were the people, Jewish background, on David Greenglass and the theft of the American atomic bomb secrets. And Julius and Ethel Rosenberg also may have not been as guilty as Roy Cohn, who was the prosecutor in the case. But what the Justice Department did, the U.S. Justice Department did at that time, they didn't want to appear anti-Semitic. So everybody, including the judge, I don't know about the jurors, was Jewish background, even though they didn't practice. So it was very interesting. It shows how these things can get manipulated, and it goes on today, especially in places like San Francisco, where we've had three major kangaroo court trials, one involving Longshoremen Riot in the 30s, the Mooney case, and I'll be getting into that, very interesting, the Rose Diakino, a Tokyo Rose case, federal case, and the Stephen Neri, which was a railroad kangaroo case in the state courts here. He was denied due process in the federal courts. His habeas corpus rights were violated. His mail was destroyed, tampered with. All kinds of things went on, fraudulent documents, intimidation of witnesses. And Jack Cashel, we will have him as a guest next week. He's working on another book. He has written many, a very articulate man. You don't want to debate this guy. he'll make mincing, he'll eviscerate you. I'm just joking, but he's very articulate, and he included the Steve Neri case, the state court part, not the military and the federal court. That's another whole ball of wax right there, and it's still coming together. In his book, What's the Matter with California, I recommend you can get it on Amazon or you can get it from jackcashel.com. I highly recommend you read that to understand what's going on in this country. He's also the controversial exposés on Obama, and especially Bill Ayers, who a growing number of people have said that he has not written that book. Incidentally, if anybody wants to call in, it's 1-347-633-9620. And also, you can go to our websites, Amicus Veritas, or type in Google, verzola.com, verzola.com, that's faster. Our email is amicusveritas@sbcglobal.net. or pverzola@gmail.com, and we'll set up again Swamp Fox, which is one of the boxes that we don't use. Excuse me. Oh, and now here's a pleasant one. In 1965, the Beatles issued this song, or composed the song, and it was published yesterday. Of course, a lot of us are thinking yesterday things were a lot better. And this is the first time in pop music that a cello was used. In 1973, we had the start of the Nixon White House tape controversies, and Rosemary Woods, that infamous photo of her where she claimed that she had accidentally erased certain tapes. And what followed was Nixon refused to turn over the tapes, which were subpoenaed by the special prosecutor, and we had the Saturday Night Massacre, where top federal justice officials were fired by Nixon, and that just moved things further, gave impetus to forcing him to face impeachment or resign. Now, this is something that nobody's brought up, but however long Barack Obama is in the White House, whether he lasts 4 years or is forced to resign, as some people, a growing number of people, are think that he should do, or if he survives 4 years, and even if he's elected another 4 years after that, will the public, will historians have access to his tapes that are done? Every president does it. And will they be the complete record, or will they be doctored? That's something people better start thinking about now. And should think about any public official who does taping, whether they're governors or senators or presidents or popes, whatever. People have a right to history. And so that's something that we better start thinking about, because, you know, you're paying for this. We're all paying for this, and it may not end up in the National Archives where a lot of this stuff belongs. For November, we're preparing, finally got an audio editor so I can edit down these tapes, and got the video thing, I think we've got it pretty well handled. It's going to be dedicated to honoring the military men who served in both wars, major wars, the tapes that I did, and we have a British soldier who, special ops, they call it SOE, Special Operations Executive. He was one of the British operatives who prevented Greece from becoming communist, because they were just about ready to sweep down from the Balkans to force the Greeks to embrace communism, or force a Greek communist government. In fact, there's a famous, it's sad that the New York Times is firing people, but it's a famous book called Elena, and it's based, it was a New York Times journalist who was a Greek immigrant whose mother was horribly tortured by the Greek communists. They burned her feet, did horrible things to her, and the son survived, and he had two sisters, and he went to work for the New York Times, and he wrote this book. I think it's called Elena, and there's a movie with one of my favorite actresses, Irene Pappas, great classic face. She was also in Electra, and Z, which is another film about radical politics in Greece. But, you know, and you've heard about what's happening to the New York Times. Many of their news people are shown the door with, I think it's 3 weeks' pay for every year that they worked in our union, and 2 weeks' pay for every year they worked if they're non-union. So, but the the corporate media has got they've lost their credibility. And, you got to get rid of these people who lie, distort, omit, and think the rest of us are gullible. We're not. So I want to thank all of you who have tuned in and listened. This can be downloaded, and somebody asked me for tapes. I still haven't figured out how to do this particular. But anyway, go to our websites, go to our YouTube. There's an eclectic number videos up there, and we'll be doing more exposing terrorism and the connection to San Francisco. Very interesting, and it goes back over 100 years. And that is YouTube, and it's Amicus Veritas, AmiCusVeritas. And so we invite you there. And so tune in Thursday, if there's no earthquake. And I didn't get my guess, but we'll see what happens. But anyway, I want to thank you all for tuning in, and listen to people like Drew Raines on Marine Disquisition and his blog talk, and other people. It's a lot of interesting people on this network. So this is Peter Paul Verzola working with the New Shadow. Thank you for listening, and I hope that you go and view my YouTube stuff on Amicus Veritas on the worldwide video web. Sorry, I've lost my voice there for a little bit. And so it's only a few more seconds to go, and I got an itch in my throat, and the dog's telling me he's got to go out, and you know what. So thanks again.